we can start, I think. Yep, that's recording. It's Olivia Fitzgerald on the 29th of December 2014. And interview number 10, it's Ron Rudd. And Ron, where were you born?
In London before the war, 1928 in point of fact.
Very good. And also we are in the Kennedy Grant Library at Halls Manor. So we can get started.
Good.
So Ron, how did you first get involved with Halsey?
With Halsey, we'd just discovered folk dancing in the early 1970s. And there were two clubs to go to. One was Bridgewater Folk Dance Club, which was then run by Robert Blackburn and still is. And he got me going into folk dancing and into calling as well. And we found out that there was Halsey Folk Dance Group where we could come and dance on a Wednesday night. And it was nice and close. And I've been a member of that, of Halsey Folk Dance Group, and in fact helped to run it for many, many years. So that was what got us coming here in the first place. And we also got involved with one or two dance display groups. Robert Blackborough had his own little group, which went locally to places like Burnham Seafront and that kind of thing. And then in those days, we came in at the tail end of the big Albert Hall folk festivals. And so we became part of the EFDSS Southwest Area Folk Dancers. And we were members of that group for a long time. And that began to get us about a bit. As well as centering on here. And then sort of coming back locally, a local man, he's Exeter, Peter Bothwick, he set up a display group called Iska Dancers, and one of my daughters and her husband were invited to join them first, and that gave us an entry, and my wife and I became members of that group, and stayed members of that group until it finally dissolved. But that did have very strong links with the manor here. Witnessed the chandeliers in the long room, and that gave us cause to be here more often and to display at the manor. And this was where a guy called Bill Rutter came in, who was responsible for this place being a folk centre in the first place, and I got to know him, and he got to know me. And the classic one was that we were having a practice session for Sidmouth Festival one afternoon down at Sidmouth on the bare arena on the concrete slab, and Bill turned up, watched us, and said, "You can all come home for tea," much to his wife's surprise, but she coped. She was dud. And That made the links even closer. And one day down at the manor here, there were other things going on. I was getting a bit more deeply involved, and I was part of the committee that ran the folk dance group. And Bill took me aside one afternoon, and he said, "Ron, I'd like you to be chairman of the Friends of Halsey," which was a group he was just setting up. That was typical Bill Rutter. He didn't ask you, he told you. And you said, "Yes, Bill," and you went and did it. So that was how I really began to get in deep, because as chairman of the Friends, there were all sorts of fundraising activities going on. But the principal one was Halsey Open Day, which the Friends were responsible for many years. And for something like 9-10 years, that was one of my major activities of the year, and it was all centred on here, of course. And it used to take me 6 to 7 months to build up everything that came together for Open Day. And it was quite a part-time job to be having, considering I was at the time plant manager for a factory that was running 24/7. So time off was sort of minimal, but we got there. You know, it was lovely to do it all anyway. And the Open Day grew and grew and grew. And in those days, I'm talking about the mid-80s, we would take £750 in the afternoon. And if you translate that into today's money, that's thousands, you know, several thousands. So we were not doing badly. And it would be frowned upon today, but we even had little dog shows out there on the lawn. And to give you an idea of the extent of it, one of our members was a professional carpenter. He was the guy who built the bar in the lounge from old church pews. But he constructed a whole set of collapsible stalls which covered the two lawns out there, and we filled those with stall holders for the day. And there were dance demonstrations. We had sides down from Bristol. We had there was one of the local schools had a keen master, and he taught them maypole dancing, and they would come and do maypole dancing. And the Iska dancers, of course, featured fairly heavily in those days. And that was how it grew and grew and grew. And
so you must have known a lot of the people involved.
Got to know an awful lot of people. Yes, folkies. I mean, you know, even the ice cream man who came regularly. He came down from Bristol somewhere every year, you know. But yes, I was in touch with all sorts of folk dance group people, like Bristol Fashion and that kind of thing, and Step Clog Sides. There's a local one called Sweet Coppin. Various Morris sides, Taunton Dean Morris and West Somerset Morris. I got to know them very well, and I still do, because one of them happens to be a son-in-law nowadays. And so it was all very close-knit in those days, and people turned up and gave their all, and we had lovely afternoons. We had the odd thunderstorm as well, which enlivened matters.
So what did you do when those events happened? Were you taking part in the dancing?
I would occasionally take part in the dances, but mostly I would be the guy rushing about the place, solving all the minute-by-minute problems that always happen.
What sort of problems were there?
Anything from cars stuck in the drive to a collapsed stall, to somebody having a hissy fit, or a shortage of something, you know, all the little human problems that do crop up on a day like that, and just had to deal with them.
But were they a success generally?
Generally speaking, they were a great success, and they helped with the funding of the manor very considerably in those days, yeah. Mm.
So what did people pay to come?
I think in those days it was something like 50 pence, you know, entrance fee. There is a little field just over beyond the manor there, which we'd have a Morris side on car park duty, and they'd be out there, and they would cram that field solid with cars. They'd be parked all along the bottom lane, and even out along the main road. Attendance was that high in those days, you know. So
do you have that many people coming now? Presumably it's dwindled a bit.
It's dwindled a bit, but attendances are coming back up. So that's a very good thing.
You know, do you think that is?
It's the way life has gone, I think. People are looking sort of farther afield, less local events for their enjoyment. And also, it's been a funny thing that so many people who live locally have no idea that this place even exists, let alone what it exists for. And that ignorance is just being broken down, and more local people are coming in. And we had a craft fair here a couple of weeks ago, and it was very pleasing to see the local traders from sort of Minehead and points east, who were coming here to join in and display their wares. And it turned out to be a very good day.
So you're trying to get more people from a wider range of backgrounds?
It's getting people from a wider range. Yes, just exactly that. That people don't... It's, you know, folk has always been, to an extent, a minority interest. But we've got... A number of people who are ambassadors and always have been. there's one young man who was a funny, he'll forgive me for saying this, but a funny, scruffy little boy when I first met him, about 6-7 years old. And his parents were colleagues of mine on the management of the Manor Society then. And that funny, scruffy little lad is now one of the leading lights. He's been to Newcastle University and done the folk music, folk dance course up there. And he's leading all sorts of activities, teaching and introducing young people to all aspects of traditional dancing. And I came in here one afternoon and he had a gang of youngsters practicing ballet steps. You know, that's as wide as it's spreading. Yeah. It's people like him nowadays who are really pushing the boundaries, waving the flag, whatever you like to call
and
it.
And what's this gentleman's name?
Will Lang.
Okay, I'm sure that's good for the record.
Oh, it's very good for the record. Excuse me a minute.
So do you think it's changed much over the years and you're now kind of widening the net?
It's developed an awful lot, yes, because it was... you know, the horizons were traditional folk, and those horizons have been spread for all sorts of reasons. Traffic across the Atlantic is one thing, because there have been lots, and still are, lots of American influences on dancing and music, and from other areas as well. So it's spread and spread and spread, yeah.
And for the better, do you think?
If you don't change, you eventually dwindle and disappear. We've got to go forward. Sometimes it's a bit of a sideways step as well as forward. Sometimes there's a sort of small oops and let's do that again. But mostly it's been good, sensible progress. And the modern trend, of letting young people do their own version of what we know as folk, and encouraging them to do that, and then cunningly blending them in with what we're doing ourselves, is a very good way of getting the young generations to carry on this lovely old tradition that's been mine and my family's life for many, many years now.
And have you been involved in the young folk groups up here?
Not directly, because if you look at my date of birth, I'm a bit far away from them. But I have done things. There are often groups of youngsters here, and because I'm local and easy to get at, I'm invited in to do an afternoon's elementary country dancing with them, and that can be fun. There are groups who come. They come from Austria every summer, a couple of coachloads, and every year they come through, and I spend a whole afternoon in the long room with them, giving them the basics of English country dance, which is fun because they have absolutely no idea at all when it starts. And the whooping and yelling and bouncing about and noise you get by the end of a couple of hours is quite wonderful to behold. Mm. But there have been other groups. We've had groups down from the London area. It was a little bit of a shock, but one of the people guiding that particular lot explained to me quietly that these were kids from the gun culture, the depths of London, if I can put it like that, as an ex-Londoner.
When was this?
Oh, about 4 years ago now. But they were down in Somerset. These people were a charitable group, and they'd gather up 20 or 30 of these youngsters and bring them out of London, just to show them that there is a life and what it looks like. They were amazed at things like cows in fields. And I'd spend an afternoon with them.
What do you think they thought of the place? Do you think it changed them?
Usually stunned. I think it... without a doubt it changed. This place changes everybody. Yeah.
In what way, do you think?
It's such a welcoming house. That it softens people's perceptions, and you know, you reach out to other people that much more easily. People come in here with closed faces and they open up. You know, I had a big birthday party here some years ago, and a lot of my family are as folk inclined as I am, but on my brother's side, they live on the Essex side of London, and he lived with his wife up in Norfolk, and they came down here for this big birthday party. It was 20 years since I'd seen any of them. They had no idea what they were walking into. And after the initial shock, it was wonderful to watch the way they relaxed and opened up and simply enjoyed themselves in a way that, as they told me, they'd never expected to do. And that's what Halsey does to people.
Do you think that's the nature of the dancing, or the building itself, or the people?
It's
something else.
It's both. The building's at the bottom of it because it is such a welcoming house. Mm. You know, everybody who comes here, whatever motive, says this place is welcoming, and it is. And everything starts from there, because you walk in and begin to feel relaxed and welcome and comfortable, then it's easier for you to join in and do things you've never tried before. And it all just goes from there.
And why do you think people come from so far away, like Austria? Have they heard by word of
mouth? The reputation has spread now, you know. Austria, Germany, the States. I was down here for a weekend with my eldest daughter last October, and it was a zesty contra weekend. And yes, there were people from America, a lady from Austria, who had come across specially for the weekend, determined not to miss it, you know. And this is the particularly contra dance, because it is more international. It gets abroad more wildly, and it's fairly energetic. It's quite demanding dance, but huge fun to do. And it's things like that that are spreading the reputation of this place. And of course the very careful management that goes on nowadays, because they, you know, the management themselves know how to spread the word, which perhaps we didn't in the old days. We were all amateurs, and doing what we could see fit to do and thinking what we might do next. But there is a much more professional attitude on the management and publicity side, and it has had a huge amount of benefit. So that, people come here from, I mean, not only all over this country, but from Europe and the States as well.
Do you think they're using social media to get people?
Oh, absolutely,
from
nowadays,
afar?
Yeah. Even I'm for finding out about Facebook and things like that.
Very good. But you're not involved in management anymore?
No, I've done my share. I was, as I said, I was chairman of the Friends for about 9 years, and I was on the Halsey Council for two separate sessions. and with my wife, I helped to run Halsey Folk Dance Group for many, many years. We would take a session and take a couple of years out and then be dragged back into it because nobody else was willing. So, yeah, there's an awful lot of records back there. And I figure that, I put in my two penneth on that score. And I let other people do the clever things. Now, I'm still happy and willing to help in all sorts of ways. I let other people do the management things.
So how often do you come up here nowadays?
Two, three times a month, I suppose. Something like that. I mean, it used to be literally every week. Halsey Club twice a week, and other events going on. So, yeah.
So it's close to home. How far did you say?
I'm only 11 miles away, you know. This is my other home. Simple as that.
So would you say it's like a family for you, the people here?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I walk in the door and they just say, "Hiya, Ron." Not even you again, you know. Oh, he's back, that's all right.
And what about the people that you've met here over the years? Do they tend to stay, or are they local, or do they come back?
People always come back. If they don't come back, we begin to wonder when the funeral was, you know. Now, people always come back. Other people's careers take them away from here. I mean, it's a sad business that we're losing Paul, but it's very understandable, and he has to sort of weigh the odds, and it's an advance for him, and it's better for his family, but he's done an enormous amount of good here. And that sort of thing always happens. You know, people, they have their domestic lives, and they have to make this place fit in with everything else they're doing, and when something doesn't fit, we lose them. But, you know, they're still around. We still get contact every so often. They'll show up out of the blue, perhaps.
Do you think there's a particular type of person that comes here, or is it anyone?
Well, they are all people who have an interest in singing, dancing and music. That's what brings people here in the first place. Although occasionally the manor runs courses for subjects which are perhaps remotely associated with those three things, and that brings fresh faces in. And as I said just now, when they're in here, the manor exerts its influence. And they simply enjoy being here, and they'll seek some kind of an excuse for coming back.
And which part of the folk arts is your favourite aspect? The kind of dancing?
I'm a dancer, basically. That's where it all started. I do other things as well, but when Robert Blackborough got my daughters, who were girl guides, they did their girl guides badge in folk dancing, and that's what Robert did for them. And he just never ever let go. And the whole family ended up dancing. We still are. I lost my wife some time ago, unfortunately, but there are three grown-up daughters who are all totally committed dancers. Two of them run their own step dance sides, and the other one is a dancer. Doing a variety of American dancing, which fits in with the bluegrass type of music that her and her husband play as members of a band. So it's all there. The whole family is totally committed, and I've lost the thread of it now. Us as dancers, and there was. Another thing that became very popular, there was a wonderful craze for the Cajun Jive dance.
What's that like?
That's something else. That really is. It was one of those things. I mean, you know, Frankie and I always enjoyed our dancing, and people said that we dance well together. And we were up at Matlock in Derbyshire. They used to have a spring weekend festival there. And one weekend, there was a little band turned up that played this wonderful music. It just went woof, got underneath you and lifted you. And we went into the workshop and thoroughly enjoyed ourselves. There were no problems, it just happened. We did it. And afterwards, we were not allowed to leave the room because we were surrounded by other dancers who said, right, now show us how you did that. You know, it was just something that hit the pair of us. And that went on for a long time, and we brought it down here. And for many years, there were demands for little Cajun dance workshops down here and almost any other place we went, including Sidmouth. I did Cajun workshops at Sidmouth for 2 or 3 years, that kind of thing. So that was all part of it. Because we were part of ISCA Dancers, which was quite a display team in its time, we were a big enough group to put on a complete 2-hour performance without anybody else's help. Thank you. And we danced basically 18th century dances, but we would let our hair down and do other things every now and again. And there was always the Playford dance scene. My eldest daughter and I are still going to the Bristol Playford Ball every year, and we'll come to Playford whenever it happens, you know. So it's if it's dancing, we'll do it.
So 2 hours is quite a workout. Has it kept you fit over the years?
It's kept me fit, yeah, yeah.
And have you been into competitions as well then?
No. The competition thing has just never come into it. Because our kind of dancing isn't really competitive. It's not like Strictly, although I think that's one of the best bits of television ever. But no, it's not competitive. If you're in a display team, All right, you are in a sense competing there, because you are trying your hardest to give the perfect performance, because what the people looking at you want to see is the movements and patterns and the style and everybody doing it together, and you must get it right and you must really work at it. But mostly it's pure enjoyment.
How do you remember all the moves? Is it just practice?
The moves just begin to stick after it. Everybody meets this, but that's it. You know the basic moves. You begin to learn the language of the callers. American Contra, American Square Dance, Traditional English and Playford, they all have their terms and their language, and that's what you learn. The dances are what the caller is telling you to do next. You don't necessarily need to know the dances, although they do stick. They come with the rest of it, but it's learning the basic moves, and the most basic move of all is walking to the beat of the music. You know, if you can do that, you can be a dancer.
So it's intuitive. In a certain
way it is. You're anticipating. I have to watch myself sometimes, because in an American square dance, I'm so much into that I'm actually almost beating the caller at times, which will confuse other dancers if I'm not careful.
Are you ever a caller yourself?
I've been a caller for many years, yes. That goes back to Robert Blackborough. We'd been to his weekly club about a couple of months, and he took me aside at the end of one Monday night and he said, "Ron, next time I want you to call a couple of dances." That was frightening.
Yeah, it must be difficult at first. Is it kind of quite a leadership role to be taking on?
Yeah, it is. First of all, just from being familiar with moves and responding to what the caller said, you're suddenly in a very different position. You have actually got to learn dances. You've got to know how the whole dance goes. You've got to know how it fits with the music. You've got actually to anticipate. You've got the music coming in one ear and watching your dancers, and you're in the middle, keeping the dancers with the music, dragging them round corners when necessary, not being distracted when they do something extremely unclever, which does happen, and that kind of thing. But, I mean, that was really hair-raising, but it wasn't many months before I went out and did my first full evening with a live band. And I can still remember where that was. And I've been calling ever since.
Where was it?
Down at Tiverton, there's a hotel just outside, and it was a wedding reception thing, and I had a rather fancy shirt on, which I was pleased with at the time, but that went quite well, and it encouraged me to do another one. And then, of course, with Horsey Folk Dance Group, once I began to get the hang of it, I could do an evening's calling at the group. And it all went over there. I've collected a repertoire of dances, and there's a whole set that even now I've got more or less by heart, which are the ones I do for the sort of Saturday night wedding barn dance or anniversary celebration. And there's a whole lot of others that I will pick and choose from in one of our local dance clubs. And until recently there was Tiverton. I get invited out to Weston, to Wells, and there's another one as well. But, you know, two or three clubs who like to have me come and call for them once or twice a year.
How are these dances passed down to the next generation, and how do you know them? Because some of them are centuries old.
Everything has been written down, hence this library or a great part of it. Yes, it used to be, particularly what are truly the country dances, because like folk song, like the music, they were passed down from hand to hand and mouth to mouth. The villages had their own dances, and there are a lot of old village dances which bear the same name, but they are quite different in content because they've been used traditionally in different parts of the country, and the traditions have wandered apart and people have changed and done them different ways and that kind of thing. And then there have been all the society dances which arose out of the big formal balls in country houses, and they were formally written down and they were formally taught. We had a wonderful experience at Bath one year when my eldest daughter was 18, and she'll forgive me, she's 60 now. But it was Bath was celebrating 1,000 years of the monarchy, and in the pump rooms, the whole big group of us were invited to dance the formal minuet, and that was quite something because we had some real learning sessions to do there. And you just there was one way to do it, and only one way, and you did it right, or you got severely told off. and that was an amazing evening. But that is the other extreme, because in the society, it was, you know, young ladies spent an awful lot of their time learning these dances. It was what they did. That and sewing were the permitted occupations, and the dancing was the wonderful thing that enabled them to A, get some exercise, and B, meet young men. Because in those days, the protocol was very severe, and young ladies were not allowed contact with young men except in the dance. And various dance movements were cunningly contrived so that girls and boys could hold hands and look at one another fairly closely, if only for a few seconds during the course of the dance, and get away with that. But all those things contributed to that style of dance. And it's apocryphal, but it is said that when the big ball was on at the manor house in the village, the locals would be outside the windows watching, and the cleverer ones would see what was happening and take away some of those moves and do them at their next barn dance. And so that there began to be a bit of a changeover like that. But all those society dances have been written down. They're what we generically know as the Playford dances nowadays. And there is quite a difference in style and the way it's done. They're much more formal. You can't be casual with a Playford dance, if only because the music leads you in such particular ways.
But if these dances were a way for young men and women to meet each other, there were all sorts of naughty business going on. Are there any, over the years, are there any stories of, I don't know, excitement at Horsey?
It's always been a fairly well-behaved sort of place. It has its stock of ghosts and then some.
Friendly ghosts, or?
You can't have an unfriendly ghost at Horsey. It just doesn't work. there are one or two. We had a manager here once, Mr. Green and his family. They lived in what was then the manager's flat on the third floor above here. And they had two young lads, and one day Mr. Green came from the hall into the lounge there and found his little son as white as a sheet. And he said, "Daddy, there's a grey lady just gone through the wall." I mean, he'd been entirely unaware that there was anything of that sort, and he'd seen her. And the little heart was pounding away in here. Dad was quite certain the boy wasn't carrying on, you know. And there are all sorts of little stories. People have stood in here and suddenly glanced down because they felt an imaginary dog. You know the way an animal will walk past you and just brush the back of your leg? They felt that kind of thing. And there was one night, this is one of those things again, when the hall has been between managers. We would never like to leave it completely empty overnight, so pairs of us would literally babysit the manor. And one night, Frankie and I were in bed in one of the big bedrooms, but I was actually dozing, and she thought, "Ronnie's snoring very loud." Only it wasn't me. It was an empty bed on the other side of the room that was snoring.
Sounds terrifying.
She packed up reading very promptly that night. But there are stories of a little peasant girl. It was a case of thwarted love. She was buried that way. and her lover was buried down in the village cemetery, and she would actually walk through the manor on the way to see her lover, you know, and that kind of thing. And there was a bishop, because there was an old barn out at that end where apples were stored, and it had been a chapel, and the bishop was absolutely furious. And he hasn't been seen for a long time, but the stories exist that he used to turn up and throw apples around the place. So, all sorts of tales like that.
So do people who work here generally tend to know all these tales?
They know most of them, yes, yeah. And some of them might quietly admit to having noticed something a little bit unusual, you know. Particularly members of staff who are concerned with operating the bar, because if they're running the bar, they will actually stay here overnight. Because, you know, when this place shuts at midnight, you can't get home anywhere. So they will do that and be a member of staff here.
And have you stayed over here much in the past?
Oh, many, many times, yes. As I say, once or twice we would babysit the manor when it was between managers, but we've been here for many, many weekends of all sorts of dancing, traditional English and contra and that kind of thing, square dancing. So, yes, and we would stay over for open days too. And nowadays... when we have the annual general meeting, that turns into a weekend, so we come and stay for the weekend like that. But yes, oh yes, I've been a resident here for many, many years on
and off. And are you looked after well?
Oh, very.
Got biscuits here today.
Yeah, quite. Only I'm too busy talking, aren't I?
Actually, we've just got one more last question for you.
Go on.
What do you think the future holds for Halsey?
I think that... if we keep our courage screwed up to the sticking point, Shakespeare, that the future can be tremendous. We're facing a huge single step forward with this expansion program, but if it can be achieved, and I think it will be, then the manor will be able to offer much more facility than it does at the moment to expand every activity that it does, because the new place up in the woods there will be a craft centre, and we do craft courses, you know, bow making, violin making, instrument making generally, that kind of thing, and it can expand those, and it will give much more facility for groups of youngsters to come and learn about country dancing and camp for the weekend, or as they may see fit. And it will eventually enlarge the whole facilities of the manor, because one thing that has been a major problem for many, many years is that the way hotels generally provide facilities has gone advanced tremendously. You know, what was a pleasant situation 20 years ago is just not acceptable now, and the manor is running to keep up with all those things, so that we need these physical alterations to the buildings to provide our visitors with the kind of facilities that they've become used to, so that they are as happy here as they would be anywhere else, and we can then, you know, offer them as well all the other things that I've been talking about, the dancing, the music, the singing, the exercises, in a much better way and for larger groups of people. And I think that's the way it's got to go. And more young people coming in, a wider range of people, and I'm sure that the future is bright and will stay that way.
Excellent. I think that's a good way to end it. Actually, just a couple of last things. I forgot to set some context at the beginning about your background. So you were born in Stockwell, was it?
Stockwell in London. In London, yeah.
And your parents, what were they called, and did they do?
My parents were Philip and Connie, and Mum was a housewife. Dad and... This is a little bit of something. Dad was the head cellarman at Claridge's Hotel.
Ooh.
For many, many years. And I was actually allowed and taken round once because we as I say, we lived in Stockwell, and I went to one of the local schools, and I was extremely fortunate that the school I went to had a very special master, schoolmaster, and he had a special job in that school. His job was to look out for the bright kids and nurture them. And I became one of those. Mm. It was entirely because of him that I won a scholarship and went to a school called Christ Hospital.
Which, I know the one.
You know the one? Yep.
With the funny outfit, the uniform.
Don't you dare.
Perfectly normal.
As an aside, about 4 years ago, they had a vote throughout the pupils of the school, and the pupils were 87% in favour of keeping that old Tudor uniform. So, wow. Don't mock it. It's great. But that's where the story's going, because Dad took me up to Claridge's in my school uniform, and I was treated like royalty up there. It's amazing how that works, you know. But that was it, and we moved out to the suburbs just before the war, and there is another little funny thing too. The street where I was born had a nursing home at the end of it, and what I found out many, many years later, that when I was about 3 years old, my wife's mother was giving birth to my wife in that nursing home. And I didn't meet her in London. I met her in Rugby, where I was undergoing an apprenticeship at the time. So
you were fated to meet later.
It's one of those things, you know, yeah. The labels were tied on us, and that was it.
Oh, fascinating.
Mm, yeah. Mm.
And were your parents dancers in any shape or form?
No, they were very nice people, and they brought us up very, very well indeed. But they were not in any sense musical or dance inclined. There was, I don't remember music being played at home. We listened to the radio and that kind of thing. We had people in and were sociable, but there was no music at home. I didn't get music until I went to CH. And then it started with the classics. It started with brass band music, because that was how they got 800 boys into one dining hall in 5 minutes flat. For meals, we marched up to music. And so there was the brass band music, and there were choirs, two choirs in the school and all that kind of thing. And jazz was there, by the way, and I came away from school with a lot more knowledge and interest in that kind of music. Life got very busy after that. I was working hard and just being a young apprenticeship, because it was a very full-time occupation in those days. You were doing a 48-hour week and part-time course at the college in the evenings and weekends. So there wasn't a lot of spare going. I met this pretty little girl and suddenly realised that I had to take her out. Cinema wasn't always going to work, so I rushed around, found a dance teacher, did some ballroom dancing lessons, and we started dancing like that and enjoyed that. But then that all got blown away when family arrived. And it wasn't for a number of years, and now we're back to the beginning again, when the girls were girl guides who wanted to do the guides badge. And this whole story began from that point. You know, that's the way it's been.
Yeah. Mm. And how did you end up down here? From London?
I worked at a company called BTH Rugby. I did my apprenticeship there, got my degree there. Worked there as a junior engineer for a number of years. Had a tiny part in the Festival of Britain. I was happy there, but we weren't getting anywhere. It was time to be somewhere else. And I looked up adverts and found a company called British Cellophane at a little town called Bridgewater who were looking for young research engineers. And I applied and got the job. And we came down to Bridgewater in 1957, and I became a research engineer for about 18 months. I took a particular project out from the research labs into production. And ended up as plant manager of the plastic films factory. So, you know, there's 30 years of hard work for you in 20 seconds flat. I took an early retirement from there, and literally the day after I retired, I picked up a little part-time, one-day-a-week job as secretary to the something called the Somerset Guild of Craftsmen. And that little one-day-a-week job blossomed into a full-time job and lasted me for the next 12 years.
Very nice.
Yeah. And I made an awful lot more friends there. And it developed my own craftsmanship too, because I've been... there's been woodwork at the back of everything ever since I was a tiny kid. Dad would make wooden toys. And so I watched him doing it and started making wooden things myself. I started by making things like radio sets with their own little boxes. Mm. And it's been a thread everywhere. I mean, whatever else I've been doing, there's woodwork and a workshop somewhere in the background. And in fact, this place has my paw prints all over it.
I was about to ask you about that, yeah.
Yeah. Upstairs, piping that has been blocked off and made neat and tidy so it's not dust collectors. There are three or four tables in the next room there that are all mine. And various other things I've made that are part of it. And every so often says, "Ron, this is broke, can you mend it?" "Oh, all right."
So the Ron Rudd legacy is definitely entrenched here at Horsey.
I'm afraid so.
Great. Mm. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Good. That's perfect. Goodbye.
Thank you.